Welcome to Mary's Cup of Tea, the self-love podcast for women. I'm your host, Mary Jolkowski, an author, speaker, and all-around self-love advocate. And this is the podcast that will inspire you to love yourself. Hello, self-lover. Before we dive into today's podcast episode, I want to make sure you know about my two books on self-love. If you're struggling with body image or self-acceptance, then I highly recommend you check out my first book, The Gift of Self-Love. It's a comprehensive workbook to help you build confidence, recognize your worth, and learn to love who you are. Thousands of people have this book, and the 5-star reviews are so amazing. They give me so much life. So I hope that this is something that can help you too. You can get it wherever books are sold by searching for The Gift of Self-Love or go to my website, maryscupoftea.com/book. After releasing The Gift of Self-Love and reading all your positive feedback, I realized that we really needed something to keep us going every single day. So not a deep dive workbook, but maybe like a micro dose of self-love in your daily life, which is why I wrote 100 Days of Self-Love. It's a guided journal with, you guessed it, 100 prompts that cover so many areas of life, including body, identity, purpose, emotions, mindset, relationships, and more. So you can really think of it as a metaphor multivitamin, something to keep you going, or as I like to say, growing on your self-love journey. You can get this journal wherever books are sold as well by searching for 100 Days of Self-Love or go to maryscupoftea.com/journal. It's my mission to share all the self-love tea with you. So I hope that both my books and this podcast can do just that. I'm not sure if you're sick of hearing me talk about feeling lost, but it's something that is very real for me right now. And based on a lot of people I've talked to who are in their 20s and 30s, going through some personal transitions and not really knowing what's next for them, I thought bringing Dr. Sarah Kubrick on the show would be so, so helpful. Better known as @millennialtherapist on Instagram, Dr. Sarah is a psychotherapist who focuses on existential psychology, and she's written a whole book talking about this concept of self-loss. The book is called It's On Me, and we talk about some of those elements in this conversation. If you've ever felt this way, lost, like you don't know who you really, really are, then this conversation is for you. We talk about how to answer that big question of who am I and what am I doing with my life? And also why hearing advice like go find yourself and figure out who you are is kind of unhelpful, even though I must admit it is the title of this podcast episode because it's the colloquial phrase that we most recognize, but there's a better alternative to it, which Dr. Sarah talks about in this episode. She also shares her personal journey of feeling totally disconnected from her authentic self and ultimately how she came to heal and create a more authentic sense of self. This conversation goes many esoteric, philosophical directions, and it was so fun to hang out with someone who doesn't always just like agree with everything I'm saying, but like adds to it and then gives a different perspective. And then we explore it a little bit deeper. It's just such a joy to talk to people like that. I know that since you listen to this podcast, you're probably somebody who enjoys that too. So just remember, who you are evolves over time. But if we are stuck checking boxes and pleasing others, then we will always feel a little bit inauthentic and disconnected and lost in life. Hopefully we can be on this journey together of figuring out what's next, or at the very least, finding a little bit more peace and contentment in not having everything figured out. Without further ado, please welcome Dr. Sarah Kubrick to the show. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Likewise, especially because this topic is something that I'm feeling personally victimized by, feeling lost, trying to find myself. I don't know if a lot of my listeners are in the same boat, but I'm hosting an entire retreat around this theme. And there's at minimum 20 people who have said, yes, I feel this way too. So if anything, it's for them.
I love that. Well, we're not alone. Good.
I want to start in a kind of like a roundabout way by asking you about something we just kind of started chatting about organically before we hit record. You just arrived back home in Australia. And I know you somewhat identify as like being nomadic and you've traveled to many places. I'm curious, what is it about the land down under that resonates with you?
Honestly, I think it's the fact that my entire family lives here. So that was not always the case. We all immigrated to Canada together and then one by one just would come visit and never leave. No, but it was kind of like a slow migration. When COVID hit, I realized I was the only one living in Canada, and that felt really weird and disorienting and kind of lonely. And I also wanted to be close to my family. And so in 2020, I moved here, and the beaches alone are enough. Brunches alone are enough. But the fact that my whole family is here, the weather is beautiful. It's like a place I genuinely feel like is my home now, which I haven't had that feeling in a really long time.
That's a really important feeling to have for like ultimate self-fulfillment.
Absolutely. As much as being nomadic is fun and I still travel a lot, I think even just knowing there's that base and there's a place where I keep my books, like my body, literally the second I landed, just kind of took a big sigh and I felt it relax. And I think there's something really cool about that.
Mm-hmm. Beaches, brunches, books.
I'm not mad about it.
You mentioned that you immigrated to Canada and then your family slowly migrated to Australia. Where did you come from, for those who don't know?
Yeah, so I was born in Bosnia, but quickly after a war started, so then we moved to Serbia, and I lived there until I was 9, and then we immigrated to Vancouver.
What led you to studying psychology and going as far as pursuing your PhD? Because it seems like that's something that has hit close to home for you since a while.
Yeah. I feel like when you look at my life experiences in the Balkans, if you Google the Balkan conflicts, you'll see the years. But I feel like at a young age, a lot of the innocence that you have and a lot of the beauty you see in the world was kind of stolen from me. That's what it felt like. I think for a long time, you live in this space, if you're fortunate enough, of being like, a world is a really safe space and I can do and be anything. And there is a playfulness and carelessness in children that I think is wonderful. And I think that part of it was taken away very young. And I started to question, like, why do humans hurt each other at a very basic level? Like, what drives us to do the things that we do? What makes us so sad? What makes us suffer? And these, you know, very basic childlike questions then evolved into curiosity and the study of psychology. And I don't think I ever really wanted to be anything else. I can't really remember ever having a serious desire to pursue anything else. That's a question I get asked a lot of, like, when's the moment you knew you wanted to do this? And it's like, I always wanted to do this. And I think part of it is just because of my life experience.
Yeah. And you particularly focus on existential therapy. Mm-hmm. I find that in my 20s, my whole life feels like an existential crisis. One thing you've taught me is that it's not an existential crisis unless it's like actively hurting you or like affecting your well-being. So I will be more careful with those words. But just my dramatic way of saying, like, I don't think I felt this directionless since I was trying to choose like a college major and quitting all my bodybuilding fitness stuff and leaving a past life behind to pursue eating disorder recovery. And so now being here 7-8 years later feels pretty discombobulating.
Yeah. And I think the reason why it does for so many of us is because we are under the impression that it won't happen multiple times. I think if someone was like, hey, after you think you have it figured out, you're going to have another moment where you realize you don't have it figured out, maybe it would feel less threatening. I don't think it would feel more comfortable, but I think it would feel less threatening somehow. And part of it, I'm kind of glad when people have these moments of tension and disorientation, because what it's telling me is that their most authentic self is trying to orient. It's trying to be like, how can I live an authentic and meaningful life? And there's a lot of people that don't have that moment of like, wow, this is real bad. I need to figure it out. And sometimes that comes from a place of lack of self-awareness. And so when I see people grappling with it, part of me is like, wow, you're on this journey and you might not want to be on it, but it's really amazing that you are.
Oh, well, thank you. It doesn't always feel amazing, but I think
It sucks.
In recent months, you know, people say like lean into the excitement, like, oh, you don't know who you are, how exciting now you can find yourself. But I'm curious what that has been like for you, or if you can recall a time recently or if ever that you felt lost.
Oh, so lost. You know, this book is written hopefully from a place of expertise, but it is also autobiographical. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, I just wrote a book on this topic called It's On Me. And it was in my mid-20s that I felt like it completely broke me. And although now I have this like annoyingly, sometimes whimsical attitude about it, it really was one of the worst things I've ever experienced. But I think the outcome of it was so healing and so positive that I just hope others experience that as well. For me, I remember I was, I don't know, 24 years old. I was in grad school. I was married at the time. And I feel like the way people perceived me was very much like, check, check, check. Like, she's doing it right. And she's doing it so early. How impressive. Little did they know that I hated my life. And actually, I didn't realize I hated my life either until this moment that I was with a friend in a bar and he looked at me and he just went like, are you happy? And I think he was expecting a yes, and he definitely did not receive it. Instead, I just started crying and gasping for air. And I think that was horrifying for me, not only because I was embarrassed, but because it was the first time I allowed myself to realize that I was very unhappy. And the reason was that I had absolutely no idea who I was. And that manifested in just so, so many ways. And so I think my encouragement for people is like, it doesn't matter how good your life looks. If it's not your own, you're not going to be happy about it. And so a lot of people are like, this topic can't apply to me because I have it all figured out. I have all the things that other people want. And it's really not about that. It's having the things you actually want and that are actually authentic to you, because having everything else is going to feel pretty meaningless.
What are some of those ways that it manifested for you? And then from a psychological perspective, how would you describe feeling lost, or kind of like the
symptoms. The definition or the symptoms. Okay.
Yeah.
For me, the major way that it manifested was anxiety. So I'm crying with my friend in a bar. I'm like, I'm going to get myself together. So I go into the bathroom and I have this moment that is like seared into my brain where I'm splashing water on my face and I look up in the mirror and I realize it's me because she's mimicking my actions. But nothing about her do I recognize. And I'm like, I do not recognize myself at all. She seems hollow. She seems empty. And worse than that, I hate her. And I have this very big moment of like, I genuinely hate you and the life that you've created for me. And that's a very heavy feeling to hold. And then after that really intense moment, I go back to my hotel room. I order some food. I watch Friends. And I'm like, good. That was rough, but I got over it. It was like, the work is done. What a weird night. Like that was the whole thing. I thought that was it. It was not it. That was just the start of it. And I think maybe if I listened, that could have been all it, but I didn't listen. And so the next morning, because I was in LA visiting my friend, the next morning I flew home and I got my very first panic attack on a flight. And the reason why I'm sharing this is because I think I just didn't want to see it. I didn't want to do anything about it. And then my body was like, I will literally not let you go back home. I will not let you go back to the routine and the life that you so hate. And back then, my body horrified me. During my first panic attack, I went into paralysis. I had to get off the flight. Like, it was a very traumatizing experience for me. And now looking back, I'm like, I think that's the only thing that could have stopped me from living a life that was, or the self that was so lost. And I think my body literally stepped in and was like, that's enough. And it's not very uncommon that I meet individuals who sometimes struggle with anxiety, but that's how it manifested for me. Can also manifest, quite holistically in terms of like, you have a difficult time making decisions because what are you making that decision on? You have a hard time connecting with individuals because who are they having a relationship with? Like, there are just so many ways that it can show up. And I think it's really important to understand that I don't think self-loss is pathological. I think it's just like part of our human experience, but it's so painful and it can manifest in things like anxiety and depression that we do need to pay attention to it.
Do you feel like over the years, as you've become more true to you, has that anxiety subsided?
So I used to suffer from pretty extreme panic attacks for about a year and a half to the point where like I did not want to leave my room. Like I had a very hard time being out in the world. And then I started making changes and oh so painfully and slowly, you know, the panic attack ceased, but the anxiety remained. And then, you know, a couple of years in, the anxiety got less and less and less and less and less. And now it's not something I struggle with, which I understand is not everyone's experience. And I think my anxiety was very contextual. But I think as I kind of grew into myself or embodied myself, my anxiety didn't need to be there anymore because it didn't have a message to tell me. And I think that that was really cool to notice because when it started, I thought, I'm going to have to live like this for the rest of my life. And I'm not actually sure it's worth living it like this. That's how bad it was and how bad it felt.
I think that's a really important point to double click on. And I'm speaking as somebody who hasn't really struggled with anxiety, like growing up or anything. I feel it more. The older I get, the more things I find to worry about. I think to an extent that's normal. But I like that you said that anxiety, or what I heard you say, anxiety also might be like a symptom or a telltale sign of feeling inauthentic, disconnected from yourself, lost in the hustle and bustle of life and who you think you should be. And that's almost like your body telling you to maybe change course.
Mm-hmm. For me, that was absolutely it. And I will not make generalized statements because people have anxiety for a variety of reasons. And I want to respect that. But for me, that's exactly what it was. And the reason I know that that's exactly what it was is because it stopped once I course corrected. It's been almost a decade, but throughout the years when I would go off course, I'd be like, oh, I feel more anxious today. And it was wild to me that that continued to be the way that my body would warn me of me going off course.
Yeah. And you wrote it beautifully in your book. You said, some of us knew who we were and then we lost our way. Some of us never became ourselves in the first place. We grew older, we aged, our roles and functions changed, but we never grasped our essence. We became many things, a professional, a partner, a mentor, a parent, a friend, but we never truly became ourselves. Where and when were you when you wrote this?
I believe I was at my parents' house in their dining room. And I had this crazy 3 weeks where I wrote a lot of chapters. It was just like pouring out of me. There's some chapters that take a long time. And this, I think, just came into my mind. And I was feeling pretty low when I wrote it, which is interesting reflecting back. I think I was just so exhausted. And I felt very fulfilled. I felt very centered. But you can feel those things and still feel low once in a while. And I think it was one of those moments where I was like, wow, I'm tired. Life is tiring. And that's kind of how that came about.
About 3 years ago, I started putting together a playlist with uplifting, inspiring, and empowering songs. I originally did this for myself because I love music of all different genres. And every time I would notice a song that just made me feel good, I would add it to my self-love playlist. And now there are over 300 songs on my Spotify self-love playlist. And these tracks are perfect for when you're getting ready, trying to hype yourself up, or going through a struggle and need a reminder for how badass you are. If you love music as much as I do, then go to maryscupoftea.com/playlist to get the Spotify link. It will ask you for your email so that I can send you this self-love playlist. And full transparency, this will also put you on my email list where I send out a monthly newsletter about stuff I'm thinking about, personal things, things I don't really share on social media, and all the happenings in the Mary's Cup of Tea world. So go to maryscupoftea.com/playlist and let's start jamming to my self-love playlist together. I thought it was really interesting how you described your experience with anxiety and panic attacks and basically completely changing your life. I have a hot take on feeling lost, and I would love your approval or disapproval as a psychologist.
Ooh, fun. Okay,
my hot take is that more often than not, and this is anecdotal, we are not lost, we are afraid.
Mm.
And more often than not, we have like a little inkling of what that thing is. Obviously, for some people, it's like maybe their relationship not feeling 100% right, or where they live, like their home. We talked about that sense of home, not having it. For some people, it's like a difficult conversation with their parents or family or their somebody, right? I know what it is for me. I'm too scared to say out loud, but it's the thing that...
Are you good? Okay. Uh-huh. I respect that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've shared it before. I think people can deduce what it means, but I'm trying not to like go deep in the story. But really, I was interested in that trajectory of just how it manifested for you and anxiety. And then eventually leading to your book, which is called It's On Me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I get from your work overall, and I'd like you to like approve or disapprove of my little hot take, and also tell me like why you titled your book It's On Me. My little hunch based on my hot take is that there is a certain point where we have to be honest with ourselves and think like, what is that thing that we are so, so afraid of? And generally, you know, the right thing for us and the hard thing for us is one and the same. And that could kind of be like a signifier of where we can start looking for ourselves.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Super interesting. I've never thought about it too hard in terms of fear, besides societal norms and pressures and wanting to ensure that we still belong and are accepted. But I don't think you're wrong. I actually think that's really interesting. I think for me, the loss of self, and this is one of my definitions, our failed responsibility to be ourselves. Because at any point when you act, you can either be authentic or inauthentic. If you fail to take responsibility to be authentic, even if you're scared, even if it's hard, even it's going to lead to self-loss. And so the It's On Me title is really focusing on the responsibility piece. I actually really like the fear hot take. I think that's super interesting. And I think you're right in terms of we don't take responsibility oftentimes because we are afraid. Sometimes we don't know there's an alternative. It's why we don't take responsibility. Like we haven't seen it modeled by our family, or like I thought everyone else was miserable. I was like, this is just how we all exist. I didn't know there was an alternative of taking this kind of responsibility and restructuring your entire life. I didn't know that was an option. And so I think sometimes we just don't know what we don't know. And that's why we don't take responsibility. But with my title, I really didn't want it to be blaming, because I'm not saying it's on me as a way to blame myself. It's to empower myself. It's to go, it's literally, you can do whatever the heck you want. And that's on you. And that's awesome. And so for me, I hope that that title, maybe before you read it, it'll have a certain feel to it. But after you read the book, I hope that it feels different, because it was intended as a very empowering, liberating, and playful thing, which is to create the self.
I want to talk more about that. Let's put a pin in that for just a second. You said that you saw a lot of people around you miserable and you thought like, that's just how it is.
Yeah.
I would also say that a lot of people are like on the total other end of the spectrum, especially those of us who grew up with the internet where we see everyone like perfectly happy all the time. So then that is just like so isolating, and personal fulfillment feels impossible as a result. So I feel like it's like the different sides of the same coin.
Well, I would say I definitely am a bit older than you. But even when I saw that people looked happy, I just assumed they were miserable. So that's the difference where I'm like, oh, yeah, I see you're smiling. But then I see plenty of couples smiling and come to my therapy session. I see plenty of my friends post pictures after crying. And for me, I was kind of disillusioned where I'm like, okay, you look happy, but chances are, and this is like the super existential, super early trauma kind of mindset, I'm like, chances are most people are actually deeply unhappy. And I think, yeah, I took social media as kind of like a facade very early on. And I think depending on how you perceive it and how, you know, if you think it's real or not. But for me, it's like, you're smiling, but I smile in my pictures. At grad school, I smile with my pictures. I smile all the time and I'm not happy. So why would I assume that you are? And again, I was projecting, but that's kind of the attitude I had of like, no, I'm pretty sure people just don't like their lives. And that was, you know, also to make me feel better and make me feel like I wasn't responsible to change it.
That's such a good point and such a good alternate perspective. And I really love that you went with the title, It's On Me, because I think in modern, like, Insta therapy rhetoric, there's mixed messaging around like, this is what you can change and can control and can create for yourself. And this is what everybody else is doing that is putting you in this terrible situation and there's nothing you can do about it. And, you know, a lot of talk that ranges in the political spectrums and, you know, like personally or professional feelings around it. And I grew up with an intense sense of personal responsibility. So I had to kind of like tone it back to give myself grace and compassion.
Love that.
And there are times when I observe myself and then I'm like, I'm actually like not taking responsibility for this. And I actually do have sovereignty and autonomy. And if I were to lean into that and have the courage, honestly, to take certain leaps.
I absolutely love that. I actually talk about individuals that take too much responsibility. And I talk about how that's irresponsible. Because if you're taking responsibility that's not yours, you're not actually being responsible for yourself. You're trying to be responsible for other people and you're taking too much responsibility and hurting yourself. I wrote it way better than I'm saying it. People fall into two categories, way too much responsibility, which, you know, it has its benefits sometimes, as long as you learn to give yourself grace and ease off eventually. And then individuals that never take responsibility. I think it's really difficult to figure out when it's actually on me, because it's on me only sometimes. It's not on you in all contexts at all times, because sometimes it really wasn't your responsibility and wasn't your fault. So I think part of knowing when it's on you is also knowing when it's not on you.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Being overly responsible is in ways irresponsible. You're also like robbing the other party of their growth.
And their responsibility, which, yeah, I hope that they take exactly because they won't grow without it.
Circling back to creating the self, again, when you wrote, we became many things, a professional partner, mentor, parent, friend, but we never truly became ourself. In your beautiful, eloquent description of finding yourself, becoming yourself, you said specifically creating yourself.
Yes.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming that there's probably some things that are misaligned in the phrases that we use, like find yourself, find your purpose, figure out who you are. What do you think of this type of advice?
Wow, great question. Thanks for asking. No, I love talking about this. I think find yourself for me personally, especially with the existential background, is misguided. And I think it's passive. What I mean by that is, does this mean that yourself is already created? It already exists. And all you have to do is find it. It also suggests that yourself is static, which horrifies me because I'm hoping that if you find yourself at 50 and you find yourself at 30, if we were going to use that vocabulary, those would be different selves. I'm so glad that myself is not the same now as it was in my 20s or in my teens. So what I like about the create yourself and why I'm so intentional about saying is because A, it's on me then to create it. it's the responsibility piece. And because I don't think the self exists outside of how we show up in the world. I talk a lot about responsibility and freedom and choice. And I think by using those three things, we're literally creating who we become. It's what gives us flexibility to be whoever we want to be. The exact same tools that, you know, we use, such as decision-making, that create an inauthentic sense of self, are the same ones that can help us create the authentic sense of self. And, you know, you can't go into a cave and come back out and be like, I know who I am. Because you have to live in this world and figure out, is this actually who I am? So here's an example. Mm-hmm. For my doctoral dissertation, I studied infidelity, which was very fascinating. And a lot of individuals never thought that they would cheat. And then they did. So who are they? And then you have this moment of like, I see myself as someone who will never cheat, and my actions are telling me otherwise. And the world is a reflection. It's a really interesting mirror. We have two options. We go, okay, I need to change the perception of myself. So your belief and your action always has to match to feel authentic and aligned. So they're not matching.
Mm-hmm. Can you say that again?
Your belief about yourself and your actions.
Your belief and your action.
For you to feel authentic.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So if you believe you're a certain kind of way, but your actions don't reflect that, that's very disorienting. Mm-hmm. And there has to be an alignment between how you conceptualize yourself and how your actions express you. Because part of creation is self-expression. If you don't mm-hmm. express yourself, you haven't fully created yourself. We self-express all the time. And so these individuals had two options. One was to figure out, okay, I'm going to change my belief. So I am someone who cheats. And I'm okay with that, or I'm not okay with that, but I'm going to shift my belief so that there is alignment. And it goes, I cheat and my actions reflect that I cheat. Great. There is alignment now, you know, we can get into that later if we want to. But then the alternative is, I'm not someone who cheats, so I'm going to stop cheating. So you're either changing the belief or the action. And this is something that how we fine tune ourselves all the time without fully realizing it. It's like, I'm a kind, patient person, but when I get behind the wheel and someone cuts me off, I'm acting in all sorts of ways. So it's like, either I have to change my perception of who I am when I drive, or I have to change my actions. And we, I think a lot of the times do this subconsciously, where we do little tweaks and little mental gymnastics. And what we're doing is constantly creating the sense of self. And I think a lot of our attempts are misguided because they're not intentional. So when you become so intentional about every decision, about every form of self-expression, about every belief you have, then you start to create a more authentic sense of self.
I'm going to repeat it back to you to make sure that I remember. Your beliefs and your actions have to match up in order for you to feel authentic.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's run in with the example of someone who cheats. They mm-hmm. can either identify as a cheater and be real with themselves, or they can stop cheating and not be a cheater. I'm assuming there's probably like a lot of forgiveness of self to go through, and again, shedding like layers of ego and identity and reconciling grief. Relationships with others, grief. Yeah. So all of that is implied. How do we begin to go about answering the question of who am I mm-hmm. when for so long our actions didn't match up with our beliefs, or our actions were a result of other people's beliefs, social conditioning, mm-hmm. expectations?
Mm-hmm. The question I really like to ask or get people to reflect on is, what did I learn about myself today? Or what did I notice about myself today? Very non-judgmental. It is not about being like, oh my God, I can't believe I honked at that. It's about like, I get triggered when people cut me off. That feels threatening to me. That feels disrespectful to me. Okay. I notice that I get teary-eyed during commercials that have to do with dogs. And I think it's about gathering data initially, in a very neutral, curious, and open way. And there's several things that I want to say about this. When we think about creating the self,
We think that we're going to think it and then do it. And there's going to be perfect harmony and intentionality. And that's it. And I think it's more like trial and error. That gives us a lot more grace because living and being human is messy. So this is going to be messy. I think whenever psychology tries to package any sort of solution in a really simple, beautiful, easy way, I always pause for a second. Because me saying, okay, if you read my book, you'll figure out how to create yourself and it's going to be a really pleasant experience would be incorrect. I think it's going to be a really messy, playful, fun, hard, exciting, it's going to be all of it experience. And that's because you're a living, breathing human being and that's just life. And so I used an example of Julia Roberts in the book, and I'm not going to tell the whole story to our audience, but if you watch Runaway Bride, you realize that Julia Roberts plays Maggie, who doesn't know what kind of egg she likes because she always pretends to like the eggs done the same way as the men she's dating. Mm. And so there is a scene where someone calls her out on it. And she goes, it's just called changing your mind. And he goes, no, that's not having a mind of your own. And so a couple scenes later, you see her making like a dozen eggs at home, sitting at a big table and just trying them. That one scene is how I see the creation of self. Instead of just doing things randomly, you have to be aware of how it aligns, how it makes you feel. So it's not just about trying the eggs. It's about paying attention to the taste. And so I think about it in terms of like, you're going to try one kind of relationship and then another, you're going to try different, maybe even habits and beliefs and relationships, and you're going to see what works and what doesn't. And because I believe the self is constantly evolving, what may have worked and felt authentic for you at one point might not 5 years later. And that's the power of evaluation. And we're constantly evaluating if things are still tasting right. So that's kind of the advice I give is try things, taste things. You might not know if it aligns until you do it. And I, you know, separate the self and figuring out that relationship into three categories, your mind, your emotion, and your body. And if I said, which one of these do you feel the most disconnected from? I think most of us would have like an instinctual answer. And I say, you know, start with that one because targeting all three can sometimes feel overwhelming. But I would walk around and like notice I have a massive bruise on my leg. And then just be like, I have no idea where this comes from. It's like, that must have actually hurt quite a bit because it was like a massive bruise. So the fact I didn't even clock my own body and wasn't like, hey, are you okay? was like a very interesting thing. And anxiety also prompted me to kind of start with my body. So that was like the first category I started with. But, you know, sometimes breaking it down can be really helpful because it is overwhelming. It's a massive question that you will always have a different answer to as you evolve. And that is unnerving.
I really love the analogy of a bruise because I think many people can relate to that, especially people who are caretakers, mothers. Mm-hmm. The amount of times I've run into my counter and then gotten a bruise, but didn't quite remember it. And I think there are mental and emotional bruises that we get in the same way that we don't take note of.
It's beautiful. Yeah, I love that.
Well, to wrap up, I'd love to know, for the sake of being a little bit more tangible, what was your version of making eggs? Like, what did you try?
I love that. So there were several. I'll do some really tangible ones. In grad school, I was very intentional about trying different modalities to see what felt the most aligned as a clinician, what kind of therapist I wanted to be. And instead of being really stuck on what I thought I should want and be and what I thought sounded cool, I was kind of open to it. And it's like a 180 from what I'm doing right now. So it's really funny. And then the other thing that I did, and this obviously, you know, comes from a place of privilege of being able to do this, was I traveled a bit, and not like fancy traveled, like $800 in your bank account traveled. But it was, I think I really liked the fact that the only consistent thing throughout every culture, every experience was me. That kind of took away everything else that I mistook as me or that imposed on me. And it was very much like it made me more tangible. I feel like even clothes, I'd be like, how does this feel when I put it on? I am very HSP, very highly sensitive. And I never really used to pay attention to that. And then I'd put a piece of clothing on and be like, how is my body in this? Not what it looks like how does my body like this on it? And mm-hmm. So it was really testing different things, like writing out the beliefs I had and being like, what would happen if I didn't believe that I was X, Y, and Z? What if I replace that? And so really it was trying things from the most basic of literally trying different foods and being like, do I like this? To some more heady stuff like beliefs that I wanted to keep or didn't.
Yeah, I love that. I love when therapists and coaches use the words like, try it on, see how it feels. Like, what if tomorrow morning you woke up and you were a conservative Republican? Like, try it on, see how it feels.
Try it
like,
on.
Yeah. What's the freaking worst that can happen? And I think, you know, like clothes are such a very tangible way to literally try it on and find yourself in those pieces, which is why I like styling more than fashion, because I feel like I can find myself through fabrics rather than trying to adhere to the trends. So I love that. I think it's a beautiful place to wrap up.
That's really cool. I actually talk to my clients about style and fashion when they're working on the self, because I think the way that you represent yourself matters. It's the self-expression. It's not about having the fanciest clothes or, as you said, following the trends. It's about like allowing the way you present align with who you are and allow others like a window into you, and for you to look at yourself and be like, that's so cool. Like, this feels so me. And so I think it's really important. And I know sometimes it sounds trivial, but it's actually not. It might not be the first thing you work on, but I think realizing how you express yourself through your clothes, through your music, through the way you speak, all of that ultimately matters.
Agreed. Thank you so much, Sarah, for sharing your wisdom with us. I encourage everyone to get your book. It's on me. I'm so grateful to know you and to have had this conversation with you.
Thank you.
It's been so helpful. One last thing before we farewell, my self-lovers. If you've been enjoying the Mary's Cup of Tea podcast, I would greatly appreciate it if you could leave a review on Apple or rate the show on Spotify. You can do this by searching for the show Mary's Cup of Tea. Scroll all the way down on Apple Podcasts and you'll see stars where you can click one of the stars and leave a few kind words. It just means so much to me because I'm so behind the scenes when I'm podcasting, so I don't really get to see the impact of the show unless you leave a review. And on Spotify, there's just a button that says rate the show and it'll let you put however many stars you want. Your feedback helps the podcast grow, and as someone whose love language is words of affirmation, your kind words mean the world to me. Thank you so much for supporting the show and helping me spread the gift of self-love. I love you all so much, and I will talk to you in next week's episode.